Hi, I'm Gil Headley, and I'm the proud sponsor of the Anatomy and Movement Channel. Welcome. This conference is important. It's both groundbreaking and ground-building. Literally hundreds of thousands of us have gathered here to expand our experience of embodiment, and in so doing, evolve the embodied experience of our world. Embodiment is a practice that anchors us consciously into that which is common to us all, our human body. Regardless of our differences, and we have them, we all live out our lives in a body, and we're all connected by that shared experience. I've been developing integral anatomy for the past 25 years. I believe the human body is not a problem to be solved, but rather a gift to be received and explored. Integral anatomy is an approach to understanding the whole body, which emphasizes textural layers, continuities, and relationships. We notice differences not to create separation, but to appreciate that which unites us all. I'll be presenting here on the Anatomy and Movement Channel, as well as on the main stage, and I hope you'll join me to explore the heart of inner space. And for further study with me, check out my website, gilheadley.com. When you join my site, you'll automatically receive 3 free full-length courses because I'm on a mission to share what I've learned through my own deep exploration of the human form. And I'm certain that these courses will enhance and transform your own embodiment practice. I hope you enjoy the presentation.
So welcome, Jesse. Really excited to have you here. So Jesse's an old G of the parkour community, one of the founding members of, he's the founder, co-founder of the Movement Creative, and he's continued to develop his programming for nearly the past decade. He began intentionally practicing movement as a teenager and credits it with his own mental, physical, and social liberation. He believes movement is a human right, and that movement access is a necessity from an individual and societal perspective. So Jesse and I share an interest in systems theory and play, and I'm really excited to hear what he has to say about how we can engage in constructive chaos. So take us away, Jesse.
Thank you, Rafe. Constructive chaos. I think half of this presentation is going to be a qualifier that this is not how I'm used to presenting. So I'm very nervous to do that. I would love to be in a room or in a space, in a field, moving around with all of you and playing through these ideas. But instead, I will spend a lot of this time talking at you. And then I look forward to your questions. And I have a couple of little activities as well. Constructive chaos. So when I've coached this in the past, it has been an embodied experience, a group of people physically doing things that teach these concepts versus me talking about it. I find that way more pleasant for myself as a facilitator, and I really relate to that as a learner. Some of the things that I'm sharing are the trunks, branches, and leaves that have grown, and a little will be the roots, and others will be the seeds of this information. I'll do my best to credit sources along the way as I stand on the shoulders of giants and tether myself to kites. I recently underwent a surgery, so I'm not able to demonstrate movement, and I've decided not to include any movement in this session. I encourage you to move if you need to, mentally and physically, allow your mind and your body to wander if it wants to. I'm mostly training outdoors in all weather conditions in different spaces on a weekly basis. I do my best to shape the space I live in, mentally, physically, socially, to support the growth I'd like to make. I fancy myself a grand experimenter in designing my experience. However you fancy yourself, I hope that there's some nugget of applicable wisdom or even some contradictory spark that flickers new thoughts through you. So I'm Jesse Danger. I run the Movement Creative, and we've provided movement experiences to over 40,000 people in the past decade. We have a team of 10 coaches who currently work with around 160 students on a weekly basis, outdoor, socially distanced, masked, all weather sessions. We run summer camps, classes, retreats. And in our past We've partnered with dozens of different schools, public and private around New York City, as well as with the Department of Transportation and Parks and Recreation. We run a sliding scale program and strive to provide high quality, financially accessible movement programming. Gotten a chance to facilitate around the world, as well as work with some incredible coaches to get surface level dives into Sistema, Jeet Kune Do, contact improv, capoeira, various martial arts, dance, and movement practices. I'm fascinated with learning, and I'm doing my best to figure out what I need as a learner to be able to get the most out of any situation. The physical and mental education system I grew up with didn't resonate with me. I chose not to complete high school and have not pursued higher education. I now think that there are better ways for that system to be shaped and better ways I could have engaged with it just as it was. Last year, I went to Gallo Idrettshøyskolen School for their spring term. As a learning system, I admire this place deeply. It provides mental, physical, and social resources to support students to thrive and learn through learn what they're passionate about, and for that to be a part of tuning into your passion and learning who you are. So that space was fun and engaging. And in just a few months, I saw myself make progress on things that I hadn't in years of deep being stuck. And that was the first time as an adult that I intentionally went to a long form of education within a school. One struggle I have with this format is it demands me to capture your attention. I'm already in my head about that. I'm like trying to read these things verbatim. I want to hit on these different marks, and I want to be exciting, and that's challenging for me. I've had public and private learning. I went to a couple of different private schools growing up and a couple of different public schools. I've gone to dozens of teachers to learn in their disciplines. And across all of those, I'd say that it's very, very rarely liberated learning. That is to say, learning that I own and control, can modify, feel empowered to continue on my own. These may be my hangups, but I encourage you to think of how to support students that don't like classes, don't like teachers, and don't like being told what to do. That's close to my story. And I think it would be easy as a teacher teaching a class, telling people what to do, to write off that student and say they don't want to learn. And that's not necessarily true. It was my journey to learn how to learn from teachers and from classes. But I want to assert through this that it's not the only way to learn, just a way. And that if you're either stuck learning in classes or stuck learning out of classes, then we have mostly unintentionally divided two groups of students that could really learn from one another. I think that diversity of students is important, and that a healthy learner can learn in any environment. Whether their teacher, a person, an environment, or situation gives them very little choice about what to do, or whether they're free to make their own decisions to improve themselves. I'd love for this to be a workshop where we're dissecting games, Frankensteining them together, discussing their implications, and striving as a group to design towards seemingly impossible learning targets like community or adaptability or creativity. Do my best to simulate that and to break my own monotonous voice with an expression of the genuine excitement I have for this content, it being my personal liberation to learning, in essence, the other side of the coin from what I was taught. How can you support well-rounded growth in a system by creating activities that allow for choice? How well-rounded would we be if we went around a room and asked each person to lead a stretch or warm up on a part that feels like it needs it? Would this be more likely at meeting needs than doing it all ourselves? Can we build systems like that that allow each group to calibrate and challenge itself? And then can we guide ourselves and each other through that, opening space for group considerations and thoughts and guidance? Can we give power over to the system we're trusting? And can we change the system to support our needs? And I think also that there's some really good lessons in natural movement. I don't mean anything about a codified system. I mean what movement life humans were designed to live. And I mean what life would we have to live in order to have a healthy body just by living that life. I mean, rather than parkour is be strong to be useful, what could we do to make ourselves useful to be strong? This goes into a critical piece of our system, the environment. And to me, that's a huge variable key missing in a lot of practices. It's important to remember that these movement practices we work on are not always designed simply with everyone's best movement interest. They're also fit into small spaces with level floors, climate control. They're adjusted innumerable ways to be a commodity. That's not to speak ill of their effect. If we can introduce environment, we have a huge new partner to play with. The same games played in a field, in the woods, or on a hill, or in whatever concrete and metal structure you find, will produce different results. Hand balancing on sand, yoga on an incline, dance in a stream bed to paint a few pictures and hopefully sink our teeth into how those things would feel and be different and how we can produce different results. So this system is just one system. You could draw or create any number of them. This becomes the toolbox, the sliders that you can use to adjust your activities to produce different results. I would argue that whatever discipline you have or way you teach, that you could use this or something similar to it to more clearly conceptualize how you adjust your programming. Back to education, the odds of me listening nonstop to a lecture are slim, though they are improving. I'm an aggressive learner, and one of the things I pride myself on is my capacity to learn. So I want to share another model for learning, one that I do think can fit everyone, because it says that though we may be different learners, we can also strive to learn in any situation. Can we be dropped into an alien environment and survive? This becomes a high stakes game for me, coming out of no higher education and attempting to stake my claim at reimagining education. I almost said physical education, but I don't think these should be separated terms. As a doer, I think education is a physical thing, and that the physical thing happening in most classrooms, at least growing up, was sitting and listening. These have physiological effects on us, ones that I had to try to ignore to pay attention or to pretend to pay attention. And could we have more walks and talks, more discussions, more roughhousing, more dance, more wild play? Without wild play, I would not have learned and I would not be where I am or know what I know. I cannot credit school for teaching me very much. I can credit for teaching me that it favors certain attributes, which have, as far as I can tell, have no relevance towards success, satisfaction, or intelligence. The best excuse I've heard for these ancient systems is that it's preparing you for the real world, which seems to overwhelmingly mean the world that existed in the past, or a situation like I suffered, so you need to suffer, rather than imagining a new and beautiful system. So I'm using this a little bit as a soapbox for people like myself that learn differently, and maybe as a soapbox for everyone, acknowledging that we all learn differently and that education can support that. I'll go into my learning model shortly, but as an overview, I classify into four different categories: drill, challenge, exploration, and game. I found that while people may have their preference, most experts and masters find their way through all of these things and often are socially supported to do so by their community. I think a healthy learning diet balances these things, a recipe for success and a recipe for passion. So I want to dig into a couple of definitions just so that we're all moving from the same page. My definition of a game is a motivational system. In the case of as a movement facilitator and as a movement practitioner, it's mostly talking about a movement activity. I would say that all movement activities are some level of motivational and can fit within the systems I'm sharing. So any number of systems could be created. The system you choose will shape your results. And then within game, there's finite and infinite games. A finite game has a winner and a loser, a beginning and an end. An infinite game continues. A game of chess is a finite game. Being a chess player is an infinite game. We aim with all of our sessions to support the infinite game of being a mover, and note that everyone who is able to move in any capacity is a mover. Systems thinking, this is a way to help people view systems from a broader perspective. Can we take a step back, see the structures and patterns and cycles in these systems rather than staying within it and being married to it or stuck in it. And then there's some talks around nonlinear pedagogy, constraints-led approach to skill development, letting behavior, in this case movement, dictate the success of the programming and letting the programming be in the shaping of the environment that the student navigates through. Even with intentional linear growth, we create results outside of our intention. Can we support the navigator with the tools they need to explore rather than steer the ship for them? This is a basic model of constraints-led approach by Newell. This is not a model that I made, but I think it's interesting, balancing the task, the environment, and the performer, and then observing the performer through that to see how well it's supporting their movement goals, adjusting the task and environment to support that direction. So here is our mental model or our learning model. These are the four quadrants of it. We have things that are more teacher directed and simple. That's a drill, like do this thing this way. Exploration is, you know, can you find a new way to do that thing? Challenge is maybe bringing in an aspect of time or a very specific pass-fail situation. And play is opening up into a vast and complex system where different people could navigate in any number of different ways. We have a couple other systems, and I just wanted to show those, a couple of those as well. Here's our system around risk. This is something that we'll show to students, to parents, to our coaches, or to schools as we're coming in. And the idea is that all of these things within the system of movement could threaten the safety of a student. And when we're going into schools, coming as a parkour or a free running or art du déplacement, like we're going out and we're doing something that people perceive as dangerous. To me, of course, the way that we make this safe is the way that you make anything safe. Like, how do you make playing with knives or fire safe? How do you teach cooking? But I think it's important for us to be able to show that we understand all the different toggles and impacts on an individual. And we want our students and their parents to be mindful of that. And another way we keep things safe, we have these different systems that we share through the organization. What do we want from a warm-up, for instance? We want to be able to warm up the person, the place, the thing, and the reason that we're doing something. So those are all little pieces of the same pie, so to speak. And then I want to go into our parts of a game. So we have a system around what an activity looks like, and that's space, goal, rules, tools, challenge, movement, actions. We see this as a interconnected network, and were you to move any of these, it would affect other ones. So that when we're planning out new activities, we may not use this necessarily, but we're thinking of those different pieces. And this is just explaining all of the different pieces that we're thinking of. Like, we probably want a nice name to it. We want some kind of a why this is happening. We're thinking about where it's happening, what success in this means, what makes success difficult to achieve, what kind of movements we want people to use within it. And that's a really important one to intentionalize so that we're designing effective movement programming. What tools that could be playing with balls or bandanas or anything. And rules are just like those final details for how to make that work. So far, these past 20 minutes or so, it's all been drills. This has been the bottom left quadrant. This has been teacher directed and simple. Again, I'd prefer that and other things to be done together in person. Or if it was on Zoom, maybe we'd be doing breakout rooms or getting to know each other, taking a deep dive. But for now, we'll be using the chat box. And if I ask a question, I'll ask a couple. I'd love to see 50 answers in there. Throw a couple in there. We'll try digging into a couple of the other quadrants on that model. So as an exploration now, that's moving up. This is self-directed, and we're moving into a different quadrant. So it's a little exercise from Trevor de Groot. Let's take a game we all know somewhat, football and soccer, and try to imagine ways to change it and put those ideas into the chat. I'd love to see 50 answers. I'm going to put the parts of the game out, parts of an activity out, so you can see what could be changed. But you don't have to fit into those parameters. You can be wild and creative. I see a third team. Addition of obstacles into the field. Play on a hill. Blindfolded, need to communicate. Everyone on a pogo stick. Two balls. Larger field. Restrictions to what body part can be used. Two frisbees, two people. Allow tackling. All right, so we made a couple of pretty big changes to the game just by changing one little thing. And imagine what that would do to the rest of a system. A football on horseback might need a totally different space as a for instance. Why haven't we tried playing this in a forest? So as a little bit more of an exploration, just try really imagining playing the game with one of these changes. Think about what that would be like. Maybe you would need a different space or different rules. And this is a soccer, soccer football. So then the real nugget here is the movement implications. I'm assuming if you're here and you're hearing, you're somewhat interested in movement. And now the question is, if you made those changes, what would the changes to the player's movement be? How would movement change, and what could you learn from this new variation of the game? Yeah, let's share a couple of those implications in the chat box as well. And as football or soccer coaches, like one more recent variation is playing in a much smaller area. to increase the player-to-player interactions and seeing that really improve people's play. I think that's really fascinating that you can use this as a soccer coach, but maybe this could be for everything. So we've gone into drill and exploration there a little bit. I want to move to a challenge space now. So the challenge is to take an activity you already know and love. If you're especially daring, it's one that's precious to you. And I want you to think of a movement result that activity does not really support. And I want you to figure out how to change the system of the original activity to support that new movement result. So you have a couple minutes to do that. So for instance, if you would like one, Rafe mentions that if you were playing soccer on a stream bed, it would require far greater foot dexterity and agility and balance, and it would de-emphasize foot speed. So if he was designing soccer to support foot dexterity, agility, balance, then that could be a good modification. So if you want for this challenge portion, you can say the activity and the result you don't think it supports. I see Rafe mentions parkour and traditional agility. I'm going to put yoga and pull-ups. Emmanuel asked, he said, doesn't really understand result. This is like what you would hope to get out of the performance of that activity. So ideally we get better at what we do. And if we did pull-ups, we would get better at pull-ups, but yoga might not help us get better at pull-ups. Maybe it would. So here's the activity we're in right now. It's make it or break it, trying to learn by doing. We're using our desk and we're trying to develop an activity to support a new goal. We only have 2 minutes to make something that doesn't work. And we're writing and thinking, we're using our imagination and ideally we're doing our best. So the activity I thought of was yoga and the movement result was better pull-ups. These are random, disconnected, and I don't purport to be an expert on either of those, but I imagined a downward dog. I wondered how I could support that on a pull-up, and I think about hanging on my doorway pull-up bar with my feet on the sides of the doorframe. It looks a little bit like a downward dog in a vertical position. I imagined struggling to explore a range of motion and testing different poses and flows. Changing the space from the yoga mat to a full vertical or even an incline could get me doing more pulling. I don't know if this will support the pull-up bar or the pull-up, but I do know that it's interesting enough for me to want to play with it or to give it a shot. So in another quick chat boxing, submit the activity in the impossible challenge, which I think you may have done already. And let's try imagining into somebody else's idea. See if we can come up with a solution to a problem that somebody else presented. Thank you. Maybe type your one sentence solution to someone else's movement problem. Nice. So we'll move from here. A big takeaway shared by Trevor first around his exercise, reimagining soccer, is that there's no reason to play the same game twice. To dig deeper, I'd also say that you can never play the same game twice or do the same activity twice. Repetition is impossible in nature. Things only iterate. Your body is not the same for the second push-up as it was for the first. The practice you choose, the places you do it, the reason, the way, the why are all a part of your game. Physical risk or lack thereof is a part of your game. Even choosing to take your practice seriously or not seriously is a part of your game. I want to bring up the P word, parkour. Some people call it free running or atout de placement. At the risk of offending practitioners that identify with any or all of those words and any number of definitions for them, I think it is most like a timeless site-specific dance. There's a lot of argument and confusion around the word parkour or free running, art de déplacement. I don't want to subscribe to a word or system that would validate or invalidate a movement practice, so I call what I do movement. And my infinite game is to support myself to be a better learner and to see if I can be more useful to myself and the people around me. But let's dissolve all of that and say that all movement is movement and every site is site specific. Let's remember whatever our practice is, it was created in a different mental, physical, and social environment than it's practiced now with different goals for different people. Let's shape our own practice and support others to shape theirs. Let's release some of the preciousness and maybe try to create a new environment, a new constraints-led approach, a new activity, or a new idea for developing a new result or refining an old one. I have a couple of games that I like here. They were made with this system starting in 2014. One is Ouroboros. It's created with Jeremy Sanders and Andy Tremblay. And there's two or more people playing tag in a circle. Ouroboros is a snake eating its own tail. So you can add any number of people. And you can increase the complexity of the course. And the whole idea is that everybody is it all at once and you can only tag people in front of you. So the unexpected result of this game is that it totally pushes mental and physical endurance. You need to be very vigilant if you have any kind of movement complexity. And it can really push it to the limit. This game could be done by, you know, running a lap around a track and then having to go over a 8-foot wall. And you'll see that one additional movement outside of running just totally tax people out. Another favorite movement game is Bubble Pop. This was more intentionally designed. It was so that we would focus on moving through spaces efficiently rather than using techniques in sequence. As I see that a lot of parkour, a lot of the ways I was practicing it and a lot of the ways the people around me were practicing it was choreographing and rehearsing sequences of movements. And I questioned whether that was really improving my creativity and adaptability. So we take a structure like a jungle gym, or we play with big bar sets, and you dip that into a bubble solution. Could be a hand railing with holes underneath each of the handrails. And you have to move all the way through the hole to pop the bubble. And you're not trying to move through the same hole more than once. So you get a point every time you move through that new space. I love watching different people, different bodies, different movers solve the same problem in different ways, achieve different results. I love seeing the strategy around that. And I love all of the new movements that come out of a game like this. Because you wouldn't be able to merely stick to your movement vocabulary, your like codified list of appropriate movements. So the systems that I showed as a student, sorry, I'm gonna try to move these. I have these different. I know that I can, wherever I am on that chart, I can identify the activity that I'm participating in as anywhere else on that chart. So if I'm in a game, I can make that into a drill. If I'm in a challenge, I can make that into a game. And that itself is incredibly liberating to me as a learner. That means if I'm in a system that I'm totally overwhelmed with, which I think soccer or football is a very good example of for when I was a kid, there were just so many different things that I felt like I stunk at. And this idea around learning allowed me to see that I could just work on my communication or my footwork and support the development of myself as an infinite player, whether that's an infinite player of soccer or an infinite player in general. As a teacher, I use it as a guide for a different kind of activities environments that I want in class. I know that different activities will resonate with different people, and I support people to dig in when they love it and to challenge themselves when they feel out of their lane. So these systems become like recipes to me to make movement snacks or feasts, or to invite a group of people to make a potluck for one another. And then beyond that, we're a community. We come together as groups of infinitely wise and profound individuals with infinitely diverse goals and experiences. We create spaces where the wisdom is shared. Can we create spaces where the wisdom is shared physically and mentally? No matter what our sessions look like physically, their participants get so many different things out of them. Can we measure those things, enhance them, support them? Can we create opportunities for people to do their own work together and to connect with one another through the act of being engaged in our process while listening to the group? And can we give people the tools to navigate the cold, wide open? Can we break format and convention, give prompts as well as questions, as well as cues, and also create beautiful chaos for people to imagine their way through? Thank you. That is the presentation. I'd love to open it up to questions and see if we can unpack or dig in or nerd out.
Excellent. So we'll start with Abby Lee. She asks, actually, I think this is Louise Wong who said this. How many of your sessions are outdoors and how many are indoors? Do you deliver content differently or are your concepts applicable to both?
So right now, 100% of our sessions are outdoors. We are operating socially distanced in parks around New York City. And we're working only in small groups. So we're not working at a larger than 1-5 ratio. That has changed a lot. We've also gotten rid of like a ton of our roughhousing and physical contact games. And we've tried to adapt as many of them as possible to being distanced. Some of them were playing with like pool noodles or things like that. I'd say when we're inside without an environment that we can explore besides the besides an open space, then we'll usually use props. We use a lot of Jenga blocks and tennis balls and try to explore more conceptually. We also will build out parkour environments in the schools and places that we work so we can create something to play with and explore inside of a space. I think the easy thing for me about coaching outdoors in different spaces is this like spark of exploration and wonder, and like, hey, what about this? I find that there's always something new or some new place that I haven't like explored with movement or tried to do. Or so even taking a game that we've played 100 times and playing it in a new space is a lot of fun. And I have a hard time doing that with indoor programming.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of the outdoors myself. I love that you mentioned roughhousing. That was killer, man. I was right in the middle of building a huge, huge thing around that right when COVID hit. Which is like, but so let's get into the next question. Rodolfo asks, how did you get started in parkour?
I grew up as a skateboarder. I did a little bit of rock climbing. I liked independent sport. I played a lot of like manhunt and pickup games of like basketball and flag football and football, like out on my street. I liked moving around. I was called Monkey Boy. And then got a little bit older and I saw a parkour video. I'm pretty proud of the fact that I saw a parkour video of some teenagers that were arguably not very good at it. Going around looked like a lot of fun. So that was my first video. And then I saw videos of like David Bell, like jumping rooftop to rooftop. And I was like, oh man, like I could do that. And we showed it to another person and another person. And then we have like the whole neighborhood, like around the computer, like watching this stuff. And we're like, all right, like we can go do this. So I did the first parkour jump in the group, because parkour was all about like jumping off of things. So I went up on top of a batting cage and I jumped down like 5 meters, 15 feet, hit the ground flat, fell over, rolled. My friends rushed in. They were so excited. I killed it. It was a tremendous success. And it probably took me like a couple of years to realize that was not the smartest way to get going.
We all did it in that era. Not 5 meters though. That's a lot. 15. That's 3 meters. 15 feet. No, 4 meters. I don't know. My brain's not working. Rodolfo just is curious. What kind of surgery did you have, and hopes you heal fast.
Yeah. I had a inguinal hernia. I had about a fist sized ball of gut coming through my abdomen, and then they put like a playing card sized mesh over that hole. So my abdomen is more normally shaped for me right now, which is very nice, but I'm not cleared for physical activity, which is very rough because I use movement to support me in my mental health. So I had to learn new ways to do that, which I think ultimately is a healthy thing.
Cool. Well, the surgery now. I'm glad that you're on the road to health.
That's cool. I'm so excited about it.
Vaughn says, if there's time, can you talk to us about getting back out there with courage after an injury?
I love that question, and I don't want to be too controversial here, but I want to use one of my words. Andrew Susano, he does contact improv, and he developed something called ParkOn, using parkour and contact improv together. He says that there's no such thing as being injured. Your body is your body. You are exactly where you are. And I found that to be a very healthy thing. It was definitely a hard pill to swallow at first, because I'm often thinking of myself as the ideal version of myself, the one that is super healthy and capable of doing all the jumps that I want to do, as a jumper, all the things that I want to do. The truth is you are where you are, and if you can meet yourself there, then maybe you can enjoy that. I find that a lot easier. Like, can I find the little nerdy thing I can do at this level, rather than can I feel bad or imagine myself into all the things I wish I could do, which I'm super capable of. But for now, like, my movement challenge is learning ukulele. And that's something that I probably would not do as often if I could go out and jump around.
Lou has a question. Do you want to just unmute yourself and ask?
Sure. I didn't notice that I can't use the Q&A if I'm promoted. Just wanted to ask, in terms of chaos as a concept to you, how does this influence your creation of games?
I think chaos as a concept, or chaos as a driving point in programming and in the games that we create. Like, how can we have everybody doing the thing all at once? You know, if we were going to do it like in a line, can it happen with the whole group all moving at the same time? So the first game I thought of is the Chaos Magician. You put five different numbered or colored cones around a space, and then you partner up with somebody, and each person, each partner group has one person trying to navigate the space and one person calling out the orders. So you're running 3, 4, 5, 2, 1. And then other people are getting other orders at the same time. And now, similar to what Rafe was talking about, now you have to actually start avoiding each other, and developing like a real sense of agility and moving through the environment. The environment becomes also the group of people navigating the environment, and not only the environment in itself. Another chaos thing I like for warm-up, I call running through Times Square. So you have people starting off in different waves, running to the end of the field or the space, maybe 10 meters. And when you get to the end, you're going to walk backwards back. And now everybody running forwards has to start weaving through the people walking backwards. The people walking backwards have to just try to breathe, relax, and trust that people are going to avoid them. And the people running forwards now have to do something that I find a little bit more interesting than simply running 10 meters.
Nice. Sounds like it's training a lot of different elements, like mitigating how you manage your space and how you assert that. That's really interesting. Thank you.
Thank you. I hope it answered the question also.
I do have another question.
I think we're one more question, Lou.
Yeah, if there's time.
Yes, yeah.
I just wanted to ask, I don't know if you expanded on this, but what gravitated towards you to train in Gurlev?
I'm hugely inspired by street movement. I think that the work they're doing is really wonderful. I'm really impressed with Martin Kelso as a coach and as a leader. And I love the idea of Gallo and of Eatlot and of Hoy School. So Gallo is an Eatlot Hoy School. Eatlot is somewhere between movement and sport. I would call it wholehearted movement. That is to say, like, if we were playing a game there, everybody would be trying to do their best, but nobody was really concerned with winning. And that was pretty fascinating to see as a system-wide concept that we could all be trying very hard and not concerned about beating other people. And then Hoy School as a concept is a place developed by Grundtvig, a poet philosopher. He wondered if you had a space where everybody's needs were taken care of, if it would support them in figuring out who they are. And that's a part of the Danish educational system. So that's also beautiful that they support you to do this as a gap year or like between your PhD study, or you can also go between careers, and it's to help you get more in touch with your passion. So I think that's a beautiful concept. I'd love to see something like that happen in America. I'm interested in trying to start something like that over the next few years. And then beyond that, I think the movement culture in Denmark is pretty phenomenal. We have people of all ages moving throughout their life and moving together. We don't see that as much in America, or I didn't see that as much in America. And their general acceptance of parkour, I thought was really important for me to try to tap into. Why is it that there are over 100 parkour parks there? Why are they getting government funding for parkour? Why do parents like parkour? Why do kids like parkour? What is that about? Because I feel like me coming into parkour, like, it was very happy and healthy and positive and great for me as a teenager. And I wonder, like, how we can sway the political views. I'm thinking especially in New York City, how we can support that kind of wild play in a place where we also have to have, 11 million crowded people.
So that does bring us right towards the end of our presentation for today. So thank you everybody for the questions. Thank you, Jesse. If you guys were interested in this and you loved hearing this, it's always great to be able to digest material deep into it. A lot of these concepts around the constraints-led approach and around how we balance education and look at education in a different way are things that you might not be familiar with. And being able to dive deeper and hold on to those concepts can be really valuable. So you have 48 hours to rewatch this talk. And if you'd like to continue to have access to it, you can upgrade to the library. And links for that are in the chat right now. I would also mention that we have lots of talks that also kind of connect in interesting ways to what Jesse supported did here. We had a great talk from Jackie Wu about play, looking at it in the therapeutic context, which was amazing. I know Jamie Smith also presented on constraints-led approaches and all of the games that he's using in athletic preparation. So there's a lot of interesting, obviously is very deeply engaged in play. I'll be talking about that in a couple different contexts of meaning in life and how we look at it as a form of physical nutrition. So if you would like to, you can create a kind of whole playlist in the library about play and get a deep dive into play and the constraints-led approach, how those things interact and how you can understand them better. And that's the type of access, that's the type of thing that's going to be much easier to do once this is all done and you have a nice library to go through and review. So that's why I would recommend going ahead and upgrading. It's also great for all those of us who put many, many, many hours on for free. We'd like to be able to walk away with a little bit in our pockets from it. So that's always nice to be supported. So that's a couple reasons why you might do that. All of the information, again, is in the chat. Jesse, anything from you on where people can find you, what they need to know about you?
And anybody's welcome to email me at jesse@themovementcreative.com. I would love to talk more about all of these things. And thank you so much for being here and for listening.
Thank you, Jesse. So you can grab Jesse's information also there in the chat. And final question for you, Jesse, what is your top tip for living a more embodied life?
Top tip for living a more embodied life is don't do anything boring.
Sounds easier said than done. Excellent. Okay. Well, that will wrap us up for today. Thanks, Jesse. Thanks, Lou, for being here as well. Thank you to the tech host, and we will see you guys soon.